Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis, and today we're going to go on a really interesting journey and talk about how did student loans become so political. I think this is going to be a really interesting podcast. I think it's going to be kind of a walk down memory lane for me, going over the sort of the history of Student Loan Planner, when we started, what the different sort of contexts have been over the past several years, and just to talk about kind of where things might be going in the future. So hopefully you enjoy this pod as much as I will. And I'm going to start off with the genesis of Student Loan Planner, which was around September 2016. So obviously a very contentious partisan election, kind of like we're going through right now. With the environment that we were in then, one thing that we don't kind of remember, if you weren't following like the 2012 election or the 2008 election or the 2004 election, right, is education level has not been an extremely kind of predictive partisan indicator of your voting until recently. So, you know, if you think back to that 2004-2012 type election era, you would have people with high education levels a little bit all over the place, more so than you do today. So if you think about, you know, if you have a graduate degree or if you have a professional degree, you know, and let's say you lived on a college campus or something, you were more of like a professor type of person, well, those folks have always more leaned towards the Democratic Party. But, you know, if you have like a law degree or medical degree, you live in the suburbs, you know, in 2012, when it was Romney versus Obama, like it wasn't super clear who you would vote for necessarily just based off your education level. With the history of student loans, you know, student loans were not really considered to be this like huge political motivator for people, really, you know, as far back as I can think, sort of before the 2012 election. Now, the 2012 election, I think, is probably one of the first times it came up that I can remember. And that could be because of recency bias, because I'm, you know, in my 30s and that's what I remember. But, you know, in terms of student loans coming up in any kind of sort of like political context, the first moment that I know of or can remember, at least, is a speech that President Obama gave in the 2012 campaign season to the University of Iowa graduating class. So during the Affordable Care Act period, they passed, as part of the Affordable Care Act, big changes to the student loan system, where it actually was projected at the time to save the government money. The government was expected to earn money, which was supposed to pay for some of the cost of the Affordable Care Act. And the stuff that was supposed to pay the government money was the government sort of ending the FFEL loan program, taking over student loans directly and being paid that interest income instead of having that interest income go to private entities guaranteed by the government. During that big overhaul of the Affordable Care Act, another thing that they did was they codified the income-based repayment plan. So IBR is 15% of your income. If you borrowed your first loan before 2014, it's 10% of your income, basically mirroring the pay plan if you borrowed your first loan after July 2014. If you think about what they didn't do in that law is codify anything else, right? Like pay, repay, all those things actually came later. And so in 2012, that campaign rally for the University of Iowa's 2012 graduating class, these are seniors in 2012 that started college in the fall of 2008 for the most part. But the problem is all of those students did not take out their first loan as of 2014. They took out their first loan mostly as of 2008. And so it's kind of awkward to do a campaign rally in front of young people where young people are expected to be, you know, a big motivating factor in whether or not you turn out and whether or not you win if you're President Obama in that election, right? If you recall that political environment, 2008 was just an absolute blowout win. Didn't President Obama win Indiana, for example, I think? So, I mean, that's just like a huge win for a Democrat, right? And then in the 2010 elections, Democrats really got hit with the historic loss. Just all over the map, if it was a political wipeout, you could say, in the 2010 elections, kind of just a reaction to some of the big bills that got passed. You know, voters tend to not like change in any regard. And so when you, you know, have a bunch of change, like a lot of times you'll see the pendulum swing, right? So 2010 represented one of those pendulum elections. And then 2012, there was some concern, obviously, based off the 2010 outcome that, you know, is there a risk of President Obama being, you know, a one-term president? And in that context, they did this campaign rally at University of Iowa, and, you know, they promoted a, you know, which it makes sense, right? You're promoting a policy that's directly relevant to a lot of the people that are sitting in that cohort of people. But the IBR plan, was not available to them. The new IBR plan, the 10% of income, 20 years till forgiveness plan, was not available to them because of the way that law was written. Why did they write the law that way? Again, both parties kind of take advantage of CBO accounting rules to try to make bills say what they want them to say. And so probably they wrote that IBR bill in such a way where the current costs of that change were not really super reflected, because the way accounting rules work is you're not really supposed to, you don't really have to forecast things past 10 years. So if you take out your first loan in 2014, you know, you're not going to graduate at the earliest until 2018. And then you're having to forecast the costs of that decision in, you know, 2018 and beyond. And if you're writing the Affordable Care Act in 2009, that means that 10-year accounting cost window is almost not needed to be included at all. But the current interest income that you're going to get by wiping out the FFEL program immediately and sort of nationalizing all student loans, really, for the federal loan system, that interest income is going to show up right away, which made the Affordable Care Act cheaper on paper with the CBO scoring, which made it more politically palatable because they did not have any margin at all to spare with very tight sort of margins to bypass the filibuster and as well to get it to through the House with a lot of, you know, House members in moderate districts knowing that they would lose by voting for the bill in some cases, right? So this is like the interesting kind of background to all these student loan rules that exist today that are really confusing and really ridiculously complicated. The same is true for the passage of the PSLF program. A lot of people say PSLF is broken, it's a broken system. Well, the awkward truth is it was designed as a broken system intentionally by the people who wrote it because of what they could get past with political realities that existed at the time. Remember 2007, you had President Bush. You didn't have a Democratic president to get PSLF through, right? And so to do PSLF for FFEL loans would have involved taking away interest income from private entities, and they didn't like that and lobbied against that. And it would have involved a much, much higher cost of the bill. And with like payment offsets that have to happen, if you have any new spending, it's got to be paid for in spending cuts elsewhere or tax increases if you do things like that. So that's like a political non-starter at the time because of the way higher cost of PSLF if they had made it correct from the beginning. And they made that kind of loophole where you could consolidate FFEL loans and get access to the program. But that loophole, again, was just they didn't necessarily have to forecast how many people would take them up on that. And then, you know, people who obviously wanted the PSLF program to be designed the way they believe it should have been designed from the beginning used the low acceptance rates of PSLF initially because it was designed that way. A lot of those folks wrote the bill that way. And they use that as a messaging strategy to say, hey, we need the PSLF waiver. We've got to fix this. The system's broken, to the benefit of a lot of the people listening to this podcast, especially if you're doing PSLF. And they saw that be successful, not challenged in the courts. So they did that with the IDR account adjustment. That was fine. That was successful. So then they went even bigger, did cancellation. Then that got blocked. Then they did the save plan, went fine for a while, but eventually that got blocked, or I shouldn't say got blocked, could be blocked, but I think it probably will be. And then the third interest cancellation of canceling accrued interest that they're trying to do, Biden administration's trying to do, that is also under an injunction right now. So going again back to that 2012 election, were student loans majorly political in that 2012 election? No. This was just a one-off campaign rally that President Obama did at that University of Iowa graduating class. And then he came out with the pay-as-you-earn program specifically so that people could get early access to the new IBR plan. And by doing it in such a way where it's only borrowers that took out their first loan after 2007, October, and took out another loan after October 2011, by kind of putting those restrictions in the pay plan, again, that cost, that all-important, what is this thing going to cost estimate that everybody has to operate off of, that cost estimate was moderate. It was very, very minor in terms of the projected cost of pay. And so the regulatory action was just unchallenged. So the regulatory action was unchallenged, and so they were able to get that through. Now, interestingly enough, when you, you know, make people's payments lower and you make a lot of people's payments more affordable, what happens is if you're paying less, your accrued interest is more because you're paying less, and then the balances grow faster. What the pay program did in some ways is create or sort of exacerbate the problem of accrued interest. Obviously, yes, servicers absolutely forbearance steered and did those sorts of things, but a lot of times people were getting degrees that they just could not afford the payments for. And so from a combination of like more generous income-driven plans and forbearance and deferment options that people would stay on long-term, balances would balloon because there was no interest protections. So as President Obama was going into the end of his second term in 2016, you know, he came out with some regulatory actions with the repay plan. So the repay plan, revised pay-as-you-earn, explicitly addressed the concern that pay disproportionately benefited high-income borrowers with high debt amounts with graduate degrees. I mean, literally, that was the concern, is that the pay program is just subsidizing graduate borrowers just at a really high level. And we want to do something for undergrad borrowers that are, you know, and you know, graduate borrowers with lower balances that are maybe single, that have a couple of kids, that are really struggling with the runaway interest that, you know, is happening when people go into a lot of forbearance and deferment and just, or an income-based plan that allows low payments, but just lets the balance balloon because they'll feel the crushing weight of the debt and never be able to get out of it. Then the repay plan did not allow filing separately because it didn't. They explicitly wanted to make sure it didn't benefit people with graduate degrees as much as people with not graduate degrees. And then they also made it 25 years till forgiveness for graduate borrowers and 20 years for undergrad borrowers. And the reason for that is when you touch the interest subsidy. So here's my take on like the analysis of the CBO and stuff on student loans. So first of all, the accounting system for measuring the cost of student loans is just absolutely abysmal. Like they don't do a great job at all because it requires so many inputs and so many assumptions, and you're supposed to use discount rates like with treasuries, and it's just like it's really bad accounting in general about the way they measure student loans. Because like, let's face it, right? If you're going to go for forgiveness, the interest income the government thinks it's earning is actually not interest income at all. It's going to eventually be forgiven. And so if you're going to get forgiveness anyway, then like providing interest subsidies like through something like the repay plan actually doesn't have as much of a cost as you think it does, except that the accounting system thinks the pay-as-you-earn system is wildly profitable because the interest is accruing, even though it's going to be forgiven eventually, but the model doesn't know that with the way they do accounting. And then with the repay plan, it looks super expensive, even though it requires higher payments, simply because it subsidizes interest. And so because of being careful about what that estimated cost of the repay regulation would be, Obama administration said, let's make this interest subsidy 50% only of the accrued interest if somebody's making their IDR payment, instead of 100%, because then the cost of it would basically be double. So that's how you came out with the repay plan. And then the people writing those regs just said, well, you know, we came up with a pay plan that's helping a lot of people. We don't want to hurt those people. So we're just going to come out with a new plan. Let's just come out with repay, you know, revised page where you got two options now in addition to income-based. And what they didn't think about was the confusion that resulted when you've got not one income-based plan, but now you've got three. Student Loan Planner stepped into that in September 2016 with people having the option of repay, pay, and IBR, and accrued interest was something that would capitalize whenever you switched plans, so servicers would never switch you to the optimal plan because they would capitalize your interest. And so when I got started, there was tons of people on the IBR plan that should have been on the repay plan or the pay plan, but they weren't because the servicer didn't want to capitalize their interest. So it was just sort of like shooting fish in a barrel or something like that. Like it was just like, you're saving money, you're saving money, you're saving money. That was very easy to save people money back then, just because it was like nobody was in the right plan. People weren't even aware that they just all they had to do was switch to a payment plan. And they just needed an explanation of the accrued interest capitalizing and why that's not a bad thing. What happened in 2016 was the Trump political earthquake happened. You know, I think it's easy for us to forget, like in the Republican primary in 2016, there was like 15 candidates or something. I mean, it was just like a food fight of people running for president. I mean, the field winnowed, and every time the field winnowed, you just kept thinking like, well, Trump's not going to win. I mean, nobody's won the presidency without any political office, like basically ever, or military office, right? And then you'd keep thinking, oh, the Republican establishment's going to coalesce around Rubio or Cruz or somebody that's going to take on Trump and beat him. But with the system in the Republican primary, it's not proportional delegates. It's winner take all. It's where if in the Democratic primary you win 40% of the vote in New York and somebody else gets 30%, the Democratic primary winner gets 40% of the delegates. The second place finisher gets 30% of the delegates. In the Republican primary for a lot of states, it's like winner take all. So if you get 35% or 40% of the vote, you're getting all of the delegates, right? And so that's sort of how Trump built up that like unassailable delegate lead in 2016. Why does that all matter? Well, like for the first time, like you had, well, first time in modern history, I guess, you had a Republican presidential candidate running for president who is like super anti-trade, which is like really unusual, right? Usually the Democrats thought of the party as like pro-union, pro-labor, right? And, you know, Republican Party traditionally thought of as more business, more like free trade, low taxes, low corporate taxes kind of party. But the change of saying, hey, let's block trade agreements, these trade agreements are bad, sort of attacking at the time former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, right, over her husband's administration passing NAFTA, which was attacked as like a lousy trade deal, right? And there's all these people without college degrees that really resonated with. And so you started seeing really for the first time, like a lot of people that were really put off by a lot of the sort of the Trump style and sort of those types of things, more gravitate towards the Democratic Party in a big way that we haven't seen before starting in 2016. And then in 2016, you also saw, you know, a ton of more working class voters sort of peel off in 2016, mostly white working class voters, you know, peel off towards Trump, which was a very unusual political combination. And so what does that mean for student loans? Well, if you have a coalition of voters that is a lot more educated on one side and a lot less educated on average on the other side, obviously the only people who have student loans are people who pursue post-secondary education. So if you have a lot more of your voters having debt on one side and a lot fewer of your voters having student debt or being concerned about it on the other side, you now have a recipe for student loans to become a lot more political. So in 2012, I think it was a lot more of President Obama courting the youth vote and youth disproportionately owe student loan debt. But now in 2016, you suddenly have, you know, one coalition having more educated people in general and one coalition having lower educated people on average, right? Now, of course, there's a lot of exceptions. What does that mean for student loans in 2016? Well, everybody kind of assumed Trump would lose in 2016, and then he didn't. And then in a lot of ways, there wasn't a plan for a lot of different policy things. And the focus was very much on taxes, lowering corporate taxes. That was the big sort of focus. Then they tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. That didn't succeed, barely didn't succeed, right? So the focus was not student loans. Now, they did put forward a bill for student loans called the Prosper Act, and it would have been a lot more painful than the current system in the sense that you would have to make payments until you paid like the standard 10-year plus interest, and it would have kept some people in debt for a really long time and would have eliminated all the other income-driven plans, but grandfathered people in that were already using them. That ultimately did not pass, and the reason it didn't pass is because it wasn't just like a budgetary trick. You didn't have the votes in the Senate. You know, ultimately, the House didn't want to vote for it if the votes in the Senate weren't there, and so they didn't. So the Prosper Act was the first assault on trying to overturn PSLF, trying to eliminate all the existing IDR plans, try to replace them all with one plan, and it went nowhere. So that was an example of, you know, in 2017, you still had a lot of the elements of the older Republican Party of just, you know, let's cut taxes, let's cut spending, you know, that kind of thing. But you had it with this coalition of voters where the average education level of that coalition is lower than it's been for Republican voters in the past. After that failed, instead of doing executive actions on student loans, essentially Trump did nothing, did not mess with anything with student loans, presumably just because either he didn't care or the political trade-offs there, just like his team didn't think that it was worth it to rock the boat there, that there wasn't going to be a big benefit. So, you know, if you think about what happened going into COVID, obviously, right before an election, 6 months before, 7, 8 months before an election, President Trump wants to do things that will cause him to win, like as many presidents would do. And then, you know, shockingly pauses all student loan payments and interest, which nobody understood at the time was even possible. He just had a press conference, shot from the hip and said, hey, we're pausing all these things. And then Congress then scrambled to pass a law to like do that thing. And, you know, his legal advisors were just sort of like looking for a justification. Oh, look, Heroes Act, emergencies, we can pause student loans and modify the terms. So then Trump running up to that election, paused student loan interest and payments. And again, like that's sort of a let's not rock the boat strategy kind of thing. And so there's not really this attention on student loans for 2020. Though in the Democratic primary in 2020, is you have the reaction to Trump, who, you know, unpopular president, right, underwater on approval ratings, going into that 2020 election, you know, Democrats felt like they had a really good shot to win, right? So you attracted a lot of competition a lot of challengers, right, in the Democratic primary for the person that would be the party standard bearer who would take on Trump. And within that primary competition, a lot of times, right, in any primary, you see sort of people try to occupy a lane. But a lot of times you're occupying a lane while also trying to box out your competition that's trying to move to the left or move to the right. And so when you have this coalition of voters that's more educated in the past, on average, that you know you had as a reaction to sort of Trump's personality and policies, then you have suddenly like student loans becoming a lot more important. And you have like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are very much representing this progressive left of the Democratic Party in that primary. And, you know, as often happens, some of those policies get absorbed in part by that person who's trying to be the person who coalesces the whole party together. And so you saw, you know, Elizabeth Warren come out with a very kind of policy wonkish, aggressive cancellation plan that would cancel up to $50,000. And it was pretty well designed if the goal is to get cancellation, but not to have it go disproportionately towards people making more money. And then you had the Bernie Sanders proposal, which was more simple, which was let's just cancel all of it, right? The canceling student debt being a big part of the political conversation really started in 2020. And just my guess is part of the reason it started in earnest that year is because of just the incentives of the Democratic primary that year and just having a more educated coalition that would value that policy of student loan cancellation more. So then you get this competition over, well, who can have the best student loan cancellation plan? And eventually, President Biden kind of blesses the idea of, well, let's come up with a bill that cancels 10,000 of student loans. But, you know, President Biden is chosen because he kind of appeals possibly to some working class voters in the key swing states, some working class white voters that probably don't have student loan debt. So he's very cautious in adopting a very pro-cancellation case because in his mind, he is trying to be the anti-Trump vote recipient, right? He's not trying to become the focal point. He's not trying to become the part of the conversation. He's just trying to become the I'm not Trump person in 2020. And so he adopts a, well, yeah, I would sign a bill to cancel 10K of debt, but only if the Congress sent it to me. And then at some point, I can't remember the exact chronology. I could be a little off in terms of when he said he would cancel 10K of debt with a bill in Congress, but he did have a town hall, I remember, where somebody said, well, when will you cancel student loan debt? And he's like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that for all these folks with advanced graduate degrees that you know, went to Ivy League schools. I mean, he said that, which is kind of remarkable considering how many initiatives he did on student loans. But when Biden did defeat Trump in the 2020 election, you know, Biden needed the progressive left wing of his party to govern and to govern well and to keep support in the party so that he could potentially obviously run for a second term, which obviously he felt really strongly that he wanted to do, even though, of course, he said statements about wanting to just be a bridge. You know, obviously he felt like he was the best option in his mind to run for a second term. And so that means you got to hold on to the political left wing of your party. And one of the things he did was really kind of, I think, delegate a lot of the big decision making on student loans to sort of that Elizabeth Warren-led sort of wing of the party. What you can see is just a lot of strong allies of Senator Warren that got put into key parts of the Department of Education, key people that were involved in the CFPB or, you know, people that you'd very much identify as sort of a clear progressive. And so you have, for the first time in the Department of Education, people that are sort of unapologetically progressives. And in particular, like the COO of the Federal Student Aid Office is somebody, Rich Cordray, that was known as somebody that did have very clear political views versus more of like a technocratic person that's just sort of a bean counter, supposed, you know, kind of like a technocrat that you might expect in the Federal Reserve, for example. And so in 2021, you have a clear, what progressives would describe as mandate to overhaul the student loan system and to deliver relief. But the problem is you've got a narrow Democratic majority, very narrow, right? Recall that Vice President Harris had to cast tie-breaking votes on a lot of big pieces of legislation and Build Back Better didn't pass. And so student loan forgiveness, because Democrats know that the map, the Senate map is really challenging for them in 2024, you know, they're very cautious in a lot of these more red states to support big student loan forgiveness types of things because they view, I think, view that possibly they just don't think it's good policy in some of these red state Democrat senators, but maybe they also think that it would hurt them politically to support some of these things. So they couldn't get anything through Congress, even though they had both houses of Congress. And so what they did instead was, well, the only thing that we can do is go through the executive action route if I don't have the support in Congress. then you had people sort of going over, what can we do, right? Let's come up with some ideas. And so the idea, I think, that they had was, well, if we go really big right away, and we just say, we're just going to start canceling student loans immediately with the stroke of a pen, and if that's what we do, then that's going to block everything we do. And it turns out that that was a correct assumption. What they did is, the first big action they did on student loans was just extend the pause over and over again, because Trump had done it twice, so that took away any argument that they can't do it. And then they would extend it, and a lot of times the extensions would not really have anything to do with COVID. It was just sort of like, we want to extend it. Like, one example is when Build Back Better failed, they had repeated so many times, we're going to start student loan payments again for sure, and then they didn't, and then they retracted it because they needed to, after progressives were really upset that the key thing they wanted did not pass. They felt like student loan forgiveness extensions, or the pause extensions at a minimum, would be necessary. That was the first big thing that the administration did, just let's keep extending the pause. And there wasn't, you know, a big pushback. I'm sure there was pushback from Republicans, but it was kind of like whiny Twitter pushback, like complaining, versus actual legal actions. You know, so you had extensions of the pause. That was the first part. And then kind of what happened is, you had this sort of understanding or belief that, hey, PSLF is really broken. And, you know, it probably is broken. But again, remember earlier in the pod, we talked about that it was made to be broken intentionally to try to show a lower cost for it to get it passed in the first place. But, you know, politics is politics. Win the messaging battle, you know? So it's like, PSLF, yeah, it was broken. And so the fix is, well, let's do the PSLF waiver. And this was just very well coordinated. You had key releases of data to key reporters. You had sort of a key segment on like 60 Minutes showing all these military people who applied for PSLF and didn't get it. It was very well done. It was a very great way for the administration, through like strategic leaks and things like that, to build the case publicly for the PSLF waiver, and to make it a lot harder for Republicans to attack it if you're, you know, showcasing all these military members who've honorably served our country that didn't get benefits that they believed that they had qualified for, but got bad information, lousy information from their servicers that could have allowed them to get forgiveness. And so you get the PSLF waiver in 2022. You know, the PSLF waiver, very powerful, very generous, right? People were a little nervous about it, but it didn't get challenged legally. And I think probably the reason it didn't get challenged initially is because of the focus on helping out, you know, members of the military that could benefit from it. And so we sort of see this period of time where, you know, PSLF waiver is going on, and then they decide, okay, this didn't get challenged legally, let's do more, right? Let's do more. And so we just get into the IDR account adjustment world, where now we're going to adjust this for everybody. And I'll never forget when they came out with the IDR account adjustment rules, I was freaking out. I knew how big of a deal this was, and I was just calling reporters so excited, like, oh my gosh, this is going to be life-changing for people. And the reporters were like, leave me alone. What is this story? Like, call me when something happens. And that sort of shows why student loans are just such a non-entity, a non-factor, because like, readers only care about something once you start seeing the big headlines of how much did people actually get, how much did people actually get forgiven, or, you know, what does the CBO score say that the cost is? Like, just, that's just how people think about student loans, I think, publicly. Anyways, the IDR account adjustment got opened up, and then you just said, well, that didn't get challenged, so let's just keep going bigger, right? And obviously, President Biden, obviously, from what we know now, knew that he was vulnerable potentially to a primary challenger and wanted to make sure that didn't happen. So you got to keep that strong support of the progressive base going into a reelection battle in 2024. And so then you see cancellation, student loan cancellation come out. You see eventually negotiated rulemaking, and the SAVE plan came out. And the SAVE plan was very much trying to address the mistakes of the Obama administration in creating multiple plans that confused people, to just say, let's make one plan that is better than all the other plans. And the only thing they didn't do was keep SAVE at 20 years instead of 25 years for graduate borrowers. If they had done that, yeah, it would have been the best plan for absolutely everybody. But they didn't. And so for grad borrowers, some people needed to do pay, some people, or new IBR, some people needed to do SAVE. And SAVE also didn't have a payment cap, so some people wouldn't need the payment cap. So they came out with this SAVE plan that was supposed to be the answer to everything. Then they also announced they're going to do hardship-based forgiveness for people. They're going to do interest cancellation for people that have a bunch of accrued interest. But the problem is, it started becoming clear what the cost of these things would be in terms of like CBO cost, right? Wharton budget model costs. Like they started putting out estimates for the SAVE plan that it was like $400 to $500 billion. And the cancellation plan estimate was about $400 billion. And those numbers were enormous. And those numbers drew the attention of Republicans that would want to challenge it legally and possibly be rewarded with fame or notoriety or support of Republican primary voters and their quests for higher office, right? There has to be a political payoff for somebody generally to want to do something. And so Republicans started sensing, okay, if we can block the Biden administration on this big signature student loan thing, let's do that. Whereas something like IDR account adjustment PSLF waiver is squishy and weird and hard to understand, and so we're not going to think about that. And so they go after the cancellation first, and they win. Republicans do, in front of a 6-3 conservative majority Supreme Court, right? And they had to come up with a lot of different lawsuits to do it. They finally found one that stuck because of the standing problem. In the SAVE plan case, the SAVE plan became viewed as the backup cancellation plan that had a similar total projected cost. I think certain things triggered Republicans that wanted to sue over this. So specifically, I think the benefits to lower income, lower balance borrowers is something that a lot of the Republicans didn't like. I think that the total sticker price of it is something the Republicans really didn't like. And I think the fact the majority of people on the SAVE plan had $0 a month payments is also something that really bothered the people that sued over this. And so certain aspects of the SAVE plan, I think if they had made them a little less generous and had that headline $400 billion cost number been more modest, then I think that you might have seen less attention to that SAVE plan. Who knows, right? They might have sued over it anyway. So why would you do something differently? Anyways, you have these Republican interests that are like, we can get a political payoff for attacking the SAVE plan, and our assault on the cancellation plan worked, so why not? But they waited until the last second to do it simply because I think that they wanted the highest chance of success, and I think that they were working to get organized, and it took them a long time to get organized. And I think they waited, for whatever reason, until the actual formal rule was about to go into place to try to sue to block it. And so then that lawsuit happened, and then that lawsuit was successful with injunctions. And then the Biden administration's rolling out the hardship forgiveness, the interest accrual cancellation forgiveness program. And then, you know, more Republican elected officials assaulted that plan and got injunctions against the third cancellation effort and all other kinds of cancellation efforts the Biden administration was trying to do. And so what you have now with Trump versus Harris for this election is you have even more movement of higher educated people with professional degrees or graduate degrees disproportionately in the Democratic column, and people with, you know, more working class backgrounds disproportionately in the Republican column. And so you now have like student loans as a like Democratic Party interest group priority, and student loans as a this is unfair, this doesn't help our voters call like with Republicans, I think. And so going forward into the future, the real concern about this is if something is a priority of only one party, then you're going to see a lot of partisan battles even stronger to try to fight over it. And so right now at this moment, you know, Republicans have the advantage in the courts, you know, because the pendulum always swings in history. That's not always going to be the case. But as long as the Republicans have that advantage in the courts, they're going to continue to try to press that advantage absent congressional action. And so the big question is what happens with all these court decisions once we find out? The question is who's going to have the impetus for movement? If everything is struck down except for the IBR plan, there's runaway interest accrual. Does that cause the parties to want to work together to try to come up with a solution? It's really hard to say. My guess would be on the no column. And then if the different scenarios that could happen with the SAVE plan, you know, you could have the SAVE plan be untouched or be mostly untouched and only certain parts of it get struck down, and then it's kind of status quo. You could have the SAVE plan be blocked, but everything else is left alone. And so you have a return to the pre-COVID status quo. And then you could have the court say, well, any plan through the ICR statute doesn't qualify for forgiveness. It's only IBR plans. And so then it's only the IBR plan, which is either old IBR or new IBR, depending on when you took out your first loan. And depending on what the courts decide, you're going to see just a lot of decisions that have to be made politically over whether or not they want to try to come up with compromise. And I'm always surprised sometimes about what things Congress does compromise on versus what things they don't. Who knows, really? But the reality is student loans are super political now in a way that they were not when I started, as much so at least. And so what that means is you're going to see more instability around student loan policy. People who are really uncomfortable with that might disproportionately think about paying their loans off. And I do think that my overall formula of if you owe less than your income in student loan debt and you're in the private sector, you do need to pay off your loans probably. If you have more than 2 times your income in debt, and that's like your income's not going to go rapidly up in the next few years, if you have more than a 2-to-1 debt-to-income ratio, you need to go for forgiveness, almost surely, no matter what happens. If you're somewhere in between that 1 to 2 times your income ratio in debt, it depends on a lot of things about policies and what those policies will be, right? So PSLF policies, you know, IDR lawsuits, those types of things, you're kind of in this middle. And the question is, you know, what do you do? So we will be here for you to help you figure it out. If you have questions you'd like to ask on a future pod, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We'll try to address some of them in a future pod. And if you need a consult or a backup plan during this very chaotic time, I think an analysis of all the different things that could happen with your loans and the things that you should take action on and do to prepare for that is a valuable conversation right now. And so if you want to get a follow-up or a new consult, studentloanplanner.com/book. And again, thank you so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner Pod. Just deeply appreciate you paying attention to these podcasts and listening to them. We always want to make better shows, so you can always email me or reply back to one of my email updates if you get those with just any kind of things you'd like to see on podcast episodes like this. So hopefully you enjoyed How Did Student Loans Become So Political? And you know, hopefully you have some ideas on how that affects you in the future and what that means for you and your student loans.